The president's order to protect 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation has been welcomed by some, condemned by others. This hour, we get a reaction from one Iowa Dreamer. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, an Iowa Army National Guard unit to deploy to West Africa, how the cold snap has complicated the harvest. We talk with Iowan Jake Brown, now pot critic for the Denver Post.
There's constantly new genetics and new breeding that's happening, and so somebody has to be on top of it.
And the future of Iowa's prison population. Your Friday News Buzz starts after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The president's order to protect 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation has been welcomed by some, condemned by others. And we'll hear about that in just a moment. Coming up a little bit later, also a talk with an Iowa Army National Guard unit to deploy in West Africa. How the cold snap has complicated the harvest, and we'll talk with Iowan Jake Brown, now pot critic for the Denver Post. Last night, President Obama announced an executive order to protect 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation, a plan that infuriates Republicans but satisfies immigrants who have fought for years for such relief. Let's get some reaction from one Iowa dreamer, Monica. We're only using her first name. Monica came to the U.S. from Mexico when she was 3 years old. She's now 24 and attends the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Monica.
Hi.
You are one of thousands of undocumented residents of our state. You were at a watch party last night, I understand?
Yes. My group, Dream Iowa, put together a watch party in anticipation of President Barack Obama's announcement and what all he had to share and hopefully what who all would be covered and protected with this.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the atmosphere. What were your thoughts, perhaps the thoughts of others and feelings of others, when you heard the president speak last night?
Honestly, it was kind of like feeling relief. A lot of the people that were there with me, they are not directly impacted by President Obama's executive order, a decision. It was just people that were supporting the cause of immigration, and the feeling that everybody was feeling, it seemed like something was being lifted off our shoulders. People are able to come out of the shadows, live with, things that maybe sometimes we take for granted, like having a license, having some form of identification from the state of Iowa, having another piece to tie us to the communities here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Emotional? Were there hugs and tears or anything like that?
There were a lot of tears. A lot of applause. Some people, I think, were getting a little teary-eyed just because we know so many people, so many families that are going to be positively affected with this decision.
Mm-hmm. What does this mean for you and your family?
What this means to me and my family is that my beloved mother will now be able to have some sort of protection from deportation and be able to apply for a work permit. And it's something that she has worked really hard for. And she is the reason I am as successful as I am, from her pushing me and driving me to do better. And I feel, it's the least that she deserves.
I hear the emotion in your voice. That's very meaningful to you.
Yes, it is. With DACA, I was able to, start living the American dream. I even bought a house. And to know that these kind of opportunities are now open for my mother as well, that is, you can just imagine the emotions that are going through our family right now.
Can you understand, though, the opposition you've been taking in the media in some form or another in the run-up to this? Can you understand the opposition to this move by the president?
Honestly, I can see how some people might oppose the decision and the way that things are happening to go about. But unfortunately, a lot of people might not be knowledgeable on immigration and the laws around immigration. And I think if people had a better idea of what the law and the system really works with or works like, they might have a different opinion, especially if they knew someone that was undocumented and how much these legal restrictions really oppress them.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea that some in the opposition have that hey, you don't pay taxes, so you're here illegally, you don't pay taxes, you use government services?
Well, first of all, calling humans illegal, really, really bad term for, you know, when, and I'm not saying you did, but other people using, saying that the undocumented people here are illegals. No human is illegal. And then also not paying taxes, that is a complete myth. If anything, people that are working here undocumented are feeding in to Social Security and all these other things, paying their taxes through work. But guess what? When it's time to file taxes, they don't get anything back. If they do, very little, unlike people that are documented or U.S. citizens. So that is a complete myth, and that's what I mean, that people need to become more knowledgeable on what the reality is.
Mm-hmm. I understand you're working on a documentary having to do with the immigrant experience?
Yes. My group, Dream Iowa, is working on a documentary. It'll be a short documentary just to put a face on immigration. We're going to share the stories of a few Iowa dreamers and kind of share the story of why they had to immigrate, why their families had to immigrate to the United States, and then their life before DACA, their life after DACA, what we can contribute to the society here, to the American way of life, and then also what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. And you think that awareness raising will change attitudes?
I am hoping it really will help and have a positive impact on people, because honestly, a lot of people I talk to, they just don't know a lot about immigration. They don't know how much this greatly impacts people, and they don't know how hard. I mean, people say, get to the back of the line. There is no line to go into.
There is no line. And you hope that will be created by Congress in the coming session of new Congress?
Well, I know that's it's going to be an uphill battle to try and get something passed, but it is something that Dream Iowa and honestly undocumented immigrants that are now being helped will be fighting for nationwide.
Okay, thank you very much for this conversation. Monica, one of the thousands of undocumented residents of the state, 24 years old, and reacting to the news last night, President Obama's announcement, an executive order to protect 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation. Thank you, Monica.
Thank you.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it looks like about 80 members of the Iowa Army National Guard unit based in Washington, Iowa, that's the 294th Area Support Medical Company, is likely to head to West Africa next year to help control the Ebola outbreak. The deployment is in support of a humanitarian mission designed to stop the spread of Ebola and to keep it from becoming a pandemic that could potentially impact American citizens. Joining me now, Major Joe Provetier. He is commander of that unit, the unit that has been identified for possible mobilization to West Africa. Major Provetier, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you.
How exactly would your unit be helping out in West Africa?
Well, our main mission of the 294 is to provide medical support to U.S. and coalition service members in support of Operation United Assistance. So we will be helping with the overall mission of the building of infrastructures within the West Africa area.
Mm-hmm. What sorts of infrastructure?
Hospitals would be the main focus. At this time, I believe it's roughly about 17 hospitals that they're looking to build that could then house the local populace if the need is there.
You were notified of this, I believe, by your superior, of course, a few days ago,
yes.
Major Provetier. Can you describe what has been the reaction of the men in your unit, the men and women?
You know, I think it's a mixed bag. This is a definitely a different mission than what we've had in the last 10 years or so. So I think there's a mixture of excitement, a lot of unknowns. You know, know, there's lots of soldiers that have families that they'll be having to leave behind for a little while. Individuals in schools that will have to be put on pause, jobs, you know, and I think at this point, you know, a lot of these individuals have either been through this once before and or they're experiencing it for the first time. But, you know, there's a lot of support out there that I think allows individuals to get through this, both on the military side and the civilian.
Mm-hmm. When was the last deployment for your unit, the 294th?
We deployed back in 2009, 2010 to Iraq.
Mm-hmm. How are you dealing with the anxiety? I imagine some of your troops may be feeling the anxiety in anticipation of traveling to an Ebola-stricken part of Africa.
Yep, and a lot of this was, it's very fluid, it's moving very quickly. We just got word, you know, in the past, a lot of times you'd get, you know, close to a year to ramp up for a deployment like this. And so we're going to have, you know, 3-4 months to, you know, really understand the mission, get ready for it. And so once again, the Army puts different steps in play to help soldiers ensure that those family care plans, you know, if they need a will, if they need certain pieces, that it's there. So you go through all these different steps to ensure that you as a soldier are ready, as well as your family and or employer.
Mm-hmm. Do you know exactly where you will be deployed?
At this time, it's not a sure thing, but majority of the troops will be working out of Liberia, and then the surrounding areas will be in and out of.
Mm-hmm. This is a 6-month deployment.
Correct. Our orders will actually be for 365 days. It's anticipated that we'll be boots on the ground for roughly 6 months, though. And then in between that, or before and after that, we'll have about a month's ramp up to ensure that we're all mission ready. And then right before we can come home, we're going to be set aside for about 20 days, 21 days, to ensure that, one, the soldiers are safe and that we're not bringing anything back into the United States.
All right. Major Joe Provetier, thank you very much for your service and for telling us about this. And good luck to your unit should it be deployed.
Thank you. And we're looking forward to it and coming back home safe and sound.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. An hour of quick conversations about some news that we didn't get to wrap up the work week. Coming up this hour, we'll talk to an Iowan who has become a pot critic, marijuana critic in Denver, and we'll also talk about the medical marijuana debate here in Iowa. Hard to believe it was only last week, at the very beginning of last week, granted that, we were enjoying some pleasant fall temperatures in the 60s. That was before being plunged into record low temperatures and some snow, weather that seems more like December or January than November. It's not even Thanksgiving yet. In just a moment, meteorologist Alan Zarnetsky will join us to explain what's up with the frigid weather and what we can expect in the coming days. First, though, how has the cold snap and this snow impacted the end of the harvest season? Dean Borg joins me, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Hello, Dean. Are you faring well in the cold weather?
Good afternoon, Ben. No, I am not, to be honest. It's way too early. But farmers are even harder hit because, you know, many rushed. They used that good weather that you were speaking of and really rushed and got a lot of the harvest done, but not all completed. And in fact, you know, many worked nights, and as you well know,
right up till 10 or 11 o'clock.
That's right. Lights in the fields. And for the first time, the harvest has been, in fact, the whole crop year has been behind all year long. We've been saying 10 to 12 days, even 2 weeks behind, and then harvest a couple of weeks behind. That good weather enabled, on average across Iowa, farmers to catch up. In fact, the USDA's latest update, which was as of last Sunday, and it comes out on Monday afternoon, says for the first time this season, the corn harvest was ahead of the normal pace, 2 days ahead of the 5-year average. Now, that's the average across the state. southwest Iowa, where they've had a lot of rain, they got behind, and they're still lagging behind. And I think that in southwest Iowa, they had only 79% of the harvest, the corn harvest in there, 92% across the rest of the state.
Mm-hmm. So I was out on a farm last week, reported on that, Dean, and it was a beautiful day. But now I'm trying to imagine being in a combine when you're churning through corn. There's a layer of snow there, and you've got these frigid temperatures. It must make it much more complicated and labor-intensive and expensive with the propane.
That's right. Well, there's one thing that has worked, and that is as the season has gone on, the corn has dried in the field. I spoke with farmers out in west central Iowa, and they said it really worked their advantage. They left the corn in the field till the last minute, got it in before the snow hit, this particular farm did, and they didn't have to dry it. They were expected to spend a lot of money with LP gas, and as you say, that's expensive, but they didn't. But that's not the case across all of Iowa, of course.
Mm-hmm. You reported earlier this week about something that has complicated work on the farm that we don't usually think about. A seasonal task, very important. Liquid manure gets out of huge tanks. It's been collected and gets spread, and the frozen fields won't allow that in the normal way.
Well, what happened was with the late harvest and corn standing in the field, they can't apply liquid manure while there's still a crop in the field. And so that was delayed. And normally, corn gets out of the field, and they were still anticipating that would happen because we'd still have some days in November to do that. Well, along comes that snowstorm that you were talking about earlier. Snowstorm and cold temperatures that freeze the ground. Now, that's not good news because these farmers, that liquid manure under hog confinement, basically hog confinement, sometimes cattle too, but hog confinement, that is strictly regulated by the DNR, and you can't apply that liquid manure randomly or arbitrarily. Now, generally what happens is that liquid manure is collected in huge pits under those big buildings, and that fills up with thousands of gallons over the course of the summer. Liquid manure is applied in the spring, before the crop is planted, or in the fall, and in the fall, both times. Mm-hmm. Well, it couldn't be pumped now because
it would freeze on the fields, and they sort of inject it or knife it into the soil, don't they?
That's right. It's knifed into the soil. It can be applied. In fact, listen to this, because I reached out to the DNR and said, what about this? Farmers are getting in a pinch here. And then later called the Iowa Pork Producers Association and spoke with the spokesman there, Ron Birkenholz, and he said they don't see a problem.
No, we don't believe it is at this point. Iowa law states that surface application of liquid manure from a confinement operation is prohibited on snow-covered ground from December 21st, the first day of winter, to April 1st, and on frozen ground from February 1st to April 1st. So right now, the ground's frozen, there's snow on it, but they can still apply manure.
Well, yes, Birkenholz is right. It can be applied on the surface, but the ground is frozen and can't be knifed in, as is the optimum. And so if it's applied, according to Iowa law, on the surface, that's not as good because the DNR strictly regulates this, and that runoff has to be accounted for rather than knifed in. Mm-hmm. So they do have a problem.
Warming up a little bit on the weekend, but going forward, what can you say about the best and worst case scenarios facing farmers in the coming weeks?
Well, there's a lot of standing corn, even as you go across Iowa. 92% on the average across Iowa is harvested. As we said, down in southwest Iowa, it's a little bit behind, only about 80% harvested there. So some of this corn probably is going to stand until spring, and they'll get that out just before they have to plant a new crop.
Mm, complicated. Thank you. Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg, thanks. As promised, let's now talk with Alan Czarnecki, professor of meteorology at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Ben. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you again. As I mentioned, not even 2 weeks ago, we were basking in the fall sunshine, weren't we, with temperatures in the 60s. What happened?
Well, the weather pattern made a very definite turn, didn't it? We turned around, got the winds out of the north and northwest in the upper part of the atmosphere, and it steered a nice lobe of cold polar air down over the upper Midwest and, gosh, actually through most of the eastern half of the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And encountering, having some record lows?
We did. We had a number of record lows in Iowa. Let's see, we had record lows in Waterloo on the 18th. There were a couple of record lows on the 18th. It was 4 degrees in Waterloo, 4 degrees in Ottumwa. On November 18th, we had a record low of 9 degrees in Burlington. And on November 18th, we also had record lows of 3 degrees in Cedar Rapids, Dubuque, and Sioux City. So a number of record lows.
Mm-hmm. Now that the fall weather, even though I guess technically it's not the winter yet, now that the fall weather is over, what's the fall been like? The autumn been like overall?
Well, if we go back 7 days or so, we've been between 18 and 20 degrees below normal. If we go back about a month or so, the whole state has been about 2 to 4 degrees below normal. And even if we go back to August, the whole state has been between 1 and 4 degrees below normal. And that was coming out of a summer where the temperatures over all of except the northeast quarter of the state were also below normal. So that cool temperature trend has been continuing.
Mm-hmm. And precipitation?
We've been on the dry side, especially recently. The percent of precip has been below, despite the fact that we got a significant percent of normal snowfall this month. Actually, since the first of the month, we've been running between 125 and 400% of normal of snowfall across Iowa.
Okay, the big question everybody's tuned in for, the outlook for the rest of winter, even though winter has technically not begun yet, has it?
It hasn't, no. Typically, we think of December 1st, I guess, as for meteorologists, the start of winter. And it looks like through the first week of December, colder than normal temperatures are projected. The official outlook from the Climate Prediction Center for December and then for the three-month period, December, January, February, is what's known as equal chances. And that's not very useful because it means that it's equally likely that it could be above normal, below normal, or actually near normal. It doesn't mean that it's a forecast of near normal temperatures. That's probably the most important takeaway point.
Does not mean that.
It does not mean that, no.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that our ground is now hardened to some degree, does that influence the weather?
It does. There is that feedback. Once you have snow cover in place across the states upwind of us, Minnesota is covered with snow, and that insulates the warmer ground from the colder polar air that flows over it. It just allows that colder air to arrive much less modified than it would otherwise if there were no snow cover in place. So it's kind of a feedback process that doesn't really work in our favor this time of year.
About 20 or 30 seconds left. What's it look like up until Thanksgiving here?
Well, it looks like milder temperatures this weekend. Unfortunately, there's a pretty good chance of freezing rain. In fact, there's a freezing rain advisory from starting about 9 o'clock across the eastern half of the state. Next week, it looks a little bit active next week, so folks would do well to kind of keep in touch with the latest forecasts for Thanksgiving week.
Okay. Alan Czarnecki, professor of meteorology at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks, Alan.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, we'll talk with Iowan Jake Brown. He's now the pot critic, in fact, the first pot critic ever for the Denver Post. And we'll talk about the future of Iowa's prison population, which is expected to increase by nearly 40% over the next 10 years. We'll find out why and what's to be done. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you've heard of movie and wine critics, of course. But what about a career as a pot critic? In just a moment, we'll talk with Iowan Jake Brown. He now lives in Colorado and works as a pot critic for the Denver Post. That's right, sampling, smoking marijuana, and writing about it. But first, earlier this week, three members of the Iowa Board of Pharmacy recommended that the state take marijuana out of the strictest classification of drugs. However, the full board decided to wait until at least January to discuss the idea. Joining me now to revisit this issue, medical marijuana here in the state, Tony Lays, Des Moines Register healthcare reporter who's been following this story. Hello again, Tony.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. What happened on Wednesday at the board meeting?
Well, a subcommittee introduced a recommendation to reclassify marijuana as the board recommended a few years ago. And then the majority of the board decided they weren't ready to make that recommendation, and so they tabled the discussion, and that was sort of the end of it for now anyway.
Mm-hmm. So two questions here. If they recommended in 2010, voting 6-0 to recognize marijuana's medical value and say it should be Schedule 2 instead of Schedule 1, why do they need to make that recommendation again?
Well, legislators didn't take them up on it last time, and there are new legislators and there are new members of the pharmacy board. So although one member of the pharmacy board this time said he didn't understand why they needed to consider it since their 2010 recommendation is still sitting there up at the Capitol.
May seem like a silly question, but are all members of the Iowa Board of Pharmacy pharmacists?
No, most of them are, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm. So we, of course, may not know what exactly the difference of opinion is, but I'm wondering, because they decided to table this until January, does that give you any sense of the differences of opinion among the present Iowa Board of Pharmacy members?
You definitely got a sense in the meeting that there was some skepticism among some of the board members that the board should even be getting involved in this issue at this point. There are some holdover board members from 2010 who apparently believe that they should make another recommendation.
Mm-hmm. In 2010, what was the reaction then? Remind us of that. Was there some blowback that they would be considering now as a reason to table this or reconsider whether they want to make this recommendation again?
I don't know that there was blowback. There was some surprise. It's a pretty establishment board. It's made up of pharmacists, and that they unanimously said it should be rescheduled took quite a few people by surprise. It's important to note that the recommendation, even if the legislature acted on it, would not automatically make marijuana legal for any use.
Mm-hmm. What would have to happen to do that?
It's a big step in that direction.
What would have to happen then to do that?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, but it appears that the legislature would have to set up a program and the exact rules under which marijuana could be prescribed or recommended by a doctor, and who would distribute it, where would it come from. There's a lot of details that you'd have to work out, and the pharmacy board has made it very clear that they don't believe they have the authority to do any of those things.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the meantime, between now and 2010 and 2014, a lot of things have changed, some attitudes, no doubt, but also laws in the country, most notably in Colorado and Washington State, other ones instituting medical marijuana laws for the first time. This undoubtedly has, this context plays a part in this story.
Sure. In Iowa, legislators last spring passed a very limited medical marijuana bill. And that took a lot of people by surprise that they were willing to go that far. It only would allow possession of a marijuana oil for people who have severe epilepsy. And the law offered no way to distribute that drug or make it available here in Iowa. So at this point, the families who lobbied for it say the law is not very useful. Republican legislators and the governor have indicated they are not ready to jump to expand that law anytime soon. But you can expect those same families who lobbied for it last spring are going to be up at the State House again when the legislators come back in January.
And that was somewhat of a surprise last year in the legislative session that even this very narrow, limited use of cannabis oil made it through, wasn't it?
It was. The legislators who introduced the bill in the first place said they didn't expect it to pass, but then these families went up there and lobbied, and they had a very sympathetic story to tell of very ill children, and the oil in question does not make people high, so they managed to get that very limited bill through.
Tony, there have been some poll numbers that have indicated attitude change.
There have. Our Iowa poll, our most recent one was earlier this year, and we found that 59% of Iowa adults support making marijuana legal for medical purposes, but 69% of Iowans oppose making it legal for recreational purposes. It's a tricky number. It really depends on how you define medical purposes, so it's hard to poll on that.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any way to compare that to previous years on those same questions?
It's been fairly steady, actually, the last couple times we've polled on it. It hasn't changed a lot. It does show younger people are much more likely to support it than older people, and that has been shown in polls across the country, too.
Okay, thank you very much. Tony Lays, Des Moines Register healthcare reporter. Please keep your eye on this story, and I'm sure we'll be checking back at some point. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we all know the work of movie and wine critics. There are all sorts of critics, but what about a career as a pot critic? Yes, that's right, getting paid to smoke pot and write about it. My next guest, Jake Brown, grew up in Iowa, in Cedar Rapids. And for many years, he's lived in Colorado, where the recreational use of marijuana has been legal since the start of 2014. Jake is the first pot critic for the Denver Post. That's Colorado's oldest and largest daily newspaper. He joins me now. Hello, Jake.
Hi, Ben. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being on. Take us through the process. How do you approach a critique of a certain strain, a certain type of marijuana?
So I think what a lot of people are starting to learn now is that there are a lot of different types of marijuana. So the most important thing I can do is help them try and identify it. If you go into a store, a strain like Sour Diesel should smell like gasoline and kind of skunky, whereas a strain like Lemon Skunk should, according to its name, have a little bit of lemon to it. So what I'm helping tourists who come out here, and there are a lot of them, is to kind of identify what strains they're actually purchasing.
Mm-hmm. So let's compare it, since many of us know wine critics and what they evaluate, the color, the bouquet, the flavor of the wine, of course. What are the characteristics that you are most interested in?
I think the biggest thing right off the bat, and the thing that's most identifiable for people, is the smell. So what happens is you go into a dispensary, oftentimes they'll have lots of jars that are there. And so the idea is that you're going to be smelling these jars. What notes are you looking for? There are a few different basic ones, and then a little bit more nuanced with some strains. Additionally, you're looking for a certain type of bud structure. Some have a tendency to grow smaller and more dense. Others have a tendency to be a little stringier and longer buds. So you really want to figure out exactly what those are.
Mm-hmm. This is before you even smoke it or eat it, right?
Absolutely. So I think the big thing that happens is people don't want necessarily a sleepy high all the time or a very energetic high if they're trying to get to bed. And so being able to identify those characteristics even before you smoke gives you a much better idea of what you're in for.
Is that the main thing that people rely on you as a pot critic for? The number one thing they want to know is how this certain strain makes you feel?
Absolutely, and that's where it really differs from, say, wine criticism or food criticism, that there's a lot of different effects. In the same way that you wouldn't want to start the day off with a cup of chamomile tea, you also don't want to go to sleep with a Red Bull.
Okay, so there are different strains of marijuana for different times of day, just like espresso, cappuccino, and lattes and so forth?
Absolutely, and you know, I consider hybrids, which are going to be a combination of both indica, which is the sleepier type, and sativa, which is the more energetic. When you have a hybrid, I consider that better, almost like a happy hour kind of weed, where you can enjoy it after a long day of work, but it's not necessarily going to keep you up either.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you had a sample of something you've written about a certain pot strain handy to read.
Okay, so I recently reviewed Sour Diesel, and I said that I refer to Sour Diesel as the Campbell soup of pot because it's one of the chunkier strains out there. The calyxes are typically much rounder, giving it the appearance of more body. If most strains are a soft serve cone, Sour D is Dippin' Dots.
Hmm. What influences the quality of marijuana, the high that it gives you, the flavor that it has, the smell that it gives you? Is that the variety, the strain, but also where it's grown?
Absolutely. I would say the genetics play the largest role, that in the same way a Pinot Noir grape is always going to taste somewhat similar depending, regardless of who grows it. You also have a very important growing techniques that go into that. And there are organic grows, there are now veganic grows, and hydro, outdoor, and all of those individually make a big difference. Additionally, it depends on how you actually cure the final product. You don't smoke something that, you know, you cut down that day. It's put in a jar or some kind of container and allowed to really reach its, you know, maximum in terms of flavor and smell.
Are you high all the time at work?
I, you know, usually smoke 2 to 3 times a week in the same way that, you know, if I was, you know, critiquing microbrews, I wouldn't be drinking, you know, gallons and gallons of beer every day. Right now, I'm getting ready to go to the Cannabis Cup, however, and so I'm smoking a lot more because I'm going to need to have a higher tolerance just to kind of make it through the entire event.
The Cannabis Cup, this is a gathering in Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Absolutely. It's the 27th annual High Times Cannabis Cup, although it's recently, they've started hosting more and more events here in legal states. So the next Cannabis Cup in the U.S. will be in San Bernardino in February, and I am hoping to be a judge there as well.
Mm-hmm. How did you get this job? Remind our listeners, I'm talking to Jake Brown, grew up in Iowa in Cedar Rapids, is now a pot critic for the Denver Post in Denver.
It was one of those things where people saw the job before I did and then kept tagging me in Facebook, you know, the good old Facebook find. And so what we did is, you know, I sat down with my editor, Ricardo Baca, and talked to him a little bit about it. And he said, submit a writing sample. And that's actually my first review. It's still on the Cannabis website today, which was Granddaddy Purple.
Do you think in the future pot critics will be as common as wine critics?
I certainly hope so. I think that there are certainly enough strains to cover. I've been through 27 of them now. In my life, I've smoked easily over 100. And so there's always new things happening. It's very interesting. Compared to wine, there's constantly new genetics and new breeding that's happening. And so somebody has to be on top of it.
Mm-hmm. So in decades to come, how will we look back on this time when there are two states that have legalized recreational marijuana?
You know, I sincerely hope that it's through the lens of a failed war on drugs, the kind of empirical failure of prohibition, and that honestly, we were all worried about nothing, that people that were supportive of pot and relaxed pot laws were kind of on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm. So there were fears that were stoked there before this decision was made to legalize it that you feel haven't come true?
Absolutely. You know, there were a lot of reports that there were going to be massive incidents of people that were driving while they were high and getting into car crashes, things like that. Those haven't borne out. People were worried about easier access for children, but there has still never been a documented sale to a minor from any dispensary, whether that's recreational or medicinal. There just simply isn't an increased access because it's now regulated, it's being taxed, and it's taken somewhat off the street. And I'd also like to think that it's perhaps become a little bit less taboo.
Okay, Jake Brown, pot critic for the Denver Post and native Iowan. Thanks, Jake.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Finishing up this hour, Iowa's prison population predicted to rise nearly 40% during the next 10 years, the next decade. That means Iowa's prisons would go from the current number of about 8,000 inmates to over 11,000 by 2024. It's according to a recent report prepared by the State Department of Human Rights Division of Criminal and Juvenile Justice Planning. Joining us to discuss this for a few minutes in our Des Moines studio, Sarah Johnson, Division Justice Systems Analyst and the primary author of this report. Also, Letty Prell, Director of Research at the Iowa Department of Corrections. Sarah and Letty, welcome to our program.
Hello.
Sarah, let me start with you. How was this prediction made? What do you factor in here?
Well, there's three main factors that are taken into consideration when we create the prison forecast. First, we have to look at the number of people who are coming into prison. We have to look at how long those people coming into prison stay. And we need to look at how many people are released within a given year. And those three factors are mainly what help us produce and predict the prison population forecast.
Mm-hmm. So what else besides the number of increase, and what do you want to point out about this report that is perhaps remarkable, surprising, stands out at all?
Well, there's a few things that are really driving the forecast. One, Within the last few years, we have seen a particularly high amount of felony convictions. When you have higher amounts of felony convictions, you're also going to see increases in admissions to prison. So not only do we have higher amounts of new prison admissions, we also see increases in length of stay, particularly for people who are serving sex offenses. We also have quite a few offenders in our prison population who are serving 70% mandatory minimums, so they undoubtedly stay in prison longer and are certainly factors which are helping to increase that population.
Letty Prell of the Iowa Department of Corrections, will our prisons hold these new population, this larger population?
Well, the Iowa Department of Corrections certainly takes this forecast seriously. However, we've seen forecasts in the past that have been this high and even higher. I recall a year quite some time ago where the forecast was over 14,000 inmates. And while the prison population in 2011 did reach over 9,000, that has been our historic high so far. We view this forecast as being not set in stone, but as an indication of where we might be going if we don't examine our current policies and practices.
Mm-hmm. So what specific policies and practices, Letty Prell, do you think will be examined by the Iowa Department of Corrections in the aftermath of this report?
Well, we can't. We don't have a say over how many people come into prison. Those decisions are the legislature's, which sets the law, and the judges who sentence to prison. We also don't control how many people leave prison in a year. That is determined by the Iowa Board of Parole. What we can do is what we've been doing all along, is examining the extent to which we are motivating offenders to change and preparing them for release to supervision, because we know that release to supervision is better than letting them discharge their sentences and walking out the door and with no one to answer to. So we would like to transition them smoothly out to supervision in the community and provide for continued oversight of their behavior and to monitor their motivation and to assist them with housing and employment and all the things that will help them be successful. Our focus is going to be on that.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Johnson, as primary author of this report, what do you see as policy changes that might make this prediction be higher than it actually will turn out to be?
Well, one of the things that was addressed by Iowa's Public Safety Advisory Board is changes to Iowa's mandatory minimum sentences. As I said previously, there's a particularly high number of, there's increasing number of people in prison who are serving mandatory sentences, which are quite lengthy for forcible felony crimes. And these crimes tend to disproportionately affect minorities. So one thing that the Public Safety Advisory Board is looking at is modifications to these mandatory minimum sentences.
Mm-hmm. Letty Prell, if this prediction does come true, will Iowa have enough corrections officers, staff, to accommodate all these prisoners?
The governor and the legislature would have to take a look at what resources would need to be brought to bear if we were to receive this many.
Mm-hmm. So do you expect the legislature will be looking at this in the coming session?
We know that they always do, and that the Legislative Services Agency always takes a look at the forecast and takes a look at what resources it would take to build to these projections.
Mm-hmm. If this projection comes true, do we have the space, the cell space, to accommodate over 11,000 inmates in the next 10 years, or would we inevitably have to expand?
We would have to expand. We do not have the official prison capacity to accommodate these prisoners. However, as I said before, we have seen forecasts this high, And those forecasts have been averted through the actions of the decision makers in the justice system.
Mm-hmm. So it's not that you doubt Sarah Johnson and her colleagues' work. It's that this is a warning flag and it can be avoided with action.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. Letty Prell, Director of Research at the Iowa Department of Corrections. Sarah Johnson, Division Justice Systems Analyst and primary author of a report that predicts Iowa's prison population, if current trends continue, would rise nearly 40% during the next decade. A current number of about 8,000 inmates to over 11,000 by 2024. Sarah and Letty, thank you for coming into our studio.
Thank you.
Thanks.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. On Monday on this program, we'll take a look at diabetes in depth for the entire hour. Hope you'll tune in then. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.